This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for July and August 2013. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature readings from poets in the current issue.
This month, we'll hear from Christina Davis.
My father fought in this war, thus I can speak of it.
James Galvin.
I live on a leaf of a fern of frost.
Sadiqa Demeyer.
The day is robin's eggshell fine.
And then we'll talk with Bianca Stone about her grandmother, Ruth Stone.
She talked, especially driving, and well, all the time she would talk to herself, and she almost seemed to be talking to Walter, you know, her husband. And I think that it's similar in her poems, where in a way she's talking to the dead.
In the July and August issue, we also have poems by Kay Ryan, Philip Schultz, and Fanny Howe, among many others.
And for prose, we have Michael Robbins reviewing the new edition of Norton's Postmodern American Poetry, edited by Paul Hoover. We also have The View from Here, essays in which people from other walks of life write about their experience of poetry.
We have five of those views from here this month, and one of them is by the film critic Roger Ebert, who actually passed away very recently. He writes about the memorization and performance of poetry. Don, where do you think we should start with the poets this month?
Well, we'll hear from three poets whose work is appearing for the first time in Poetry Magazine. Christina Davis is the curator of the Woodbury Poetry Room at Harvard, and her books include Forth a Raven and An Ethic.
Her poem Mankindness has 30 sections, and we have four of them in the current issue. Christina Davis told us that the poem and its curious title stem from a shopping experience.
It came from repeatedly in an antique store in Concord, Massachusetts, seeing a sign that purports to be a translation of a line from Plato that goes something like, "We should be kind to each man we meet because he is returning from battle," or something of that to that effect.
So she began to ponder that line.
Less how it plays out on an actual battlefield, but how it plays out with the men and women that we encounter in our lives, to be cognizant of the battle within each person.
Here's Christina Davis reading four short lyrics from Mankindness.
One. Because he, because she, insofar as she, insofar as he exists, is on the way to battle. Not what is your name, but what the battle? Two. Each one of us has come here and changed, is the battle. Born a loved one. Born a loved one. Three. My father fought in this war, thus I can speak of it. My mother fought in this, thus I can speak. My friends, my lovers have fought, have worn like the tree their several directions at once, and I, insofar as I can say I, have fought to be related to these. We strive and strain, but also try to ripen the entity of the other. Four. We kiss on lips where the tenses attach. We enter the conundrum of another's becoming. We look for someone who can raise us up again to feet or near to standing. We tend in our terrors to forget. We do not store them felicities. I try each day to stay near beings, mornings when I am most mild, and may I nothing harm in case it is them.
There's so many things packed into this apparently very small space.
Yeah.
Little angular poem has all these openings. I love, there's so many things I love, but born a loved one, born a loved one.
Mm-hmm.
She just changes that B-O-R-N to B-O-R-N-E and manages to encapsulate an entire life and death in two lines.
They are short, intense bursts, some of these, and you need to think about them in a way, because they nag at you. And I sense that the impetus behind each of these sections is something that nagged at the poet.
Yeah.
There's something in that diction that's sort of nagging away.
Because he, because she, insofar as she, insofar as he exists, is on the way to battle. Not what is your name, but what the battle.
It's kind of like those disconnected but connected thoughts that you have when you're just walking around someplace trying to assimilate what's happening and whether there's something significant there.
They reminded me of George Oppen. It's a similar tone in a way, mm-hmm. but Oppen is not as psychological and not as interior a poet. He can be surprisingly interior suddenly, but not over the long haul like these are. Another thing I really love is...
I, insofar as I can say I, have fought to be related to these.
Their mother, father, mm-hmm. friends. Then it says, we strive and strain, but also try to ripen the entity of the other. Mm-hmm. That's a very odd thing, that we're trying to not prepare ourselves or ripen ourselves to be aware of this thing called the other, but to actually ripen the other, to make mm-hmm. it's as if our consciousness could become developed to the extent that an other consciousness could exist and perceive us. There's some combination of absolute solitude and communion with others in these poems. You get the feeling of both, and it's very beautifully, movingly done, I think.
It is, and it's connected to the world and to the news around us, too.
We tend in our terrors to forget. We do not store them. Felicities.
So it's a nice gift of these poems that they try to restore felicities.
James Galvin has published many collections of poetry and also prose, including the novel Fencing the Sky.
Galvin teaches at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, though he also lives in Laramie, Wyoming, the landscapes of which often inform his poems.
James Galvin is married to a poet who, as it happens, figures into the first poem we're going to hear.
My wife is also a visual artist, and she likes to draw flowers and feathers, and so we were just on our way home from town and passed some wild irises, and she decided she wanted to draw one.
The title of this poem is Roadside Ditch Natura Morta. Natura Morta is Italian for still life.
I think it's interesting because it means dead nature. Roadside ditch, natura morta. No one can draw fast enough to capture the cut iris before its form falls from its former self. But when we passed a patch in the ditch, she told me to stop, and she stepped down, opening her clasp knife. She spared one iris with an impressionistic cocoon on its stem and cut the flower beside it. Once home, she rendered in a careful hurry. She drew into the night as the iris died. I woke, grafted to her, in a vague, translucent hammock of dread.
There's something very nifty about what happens in this poem, that where it starts off, no one can draw fast enough to capture the cut iris before its form falls from its former self. I like that. It's sort of sketching and sketchy. But then as the poem sort of draws itself and pulls itself together, it ends in that amazing series of lines.
She drew into the night as the iris died.
That's a very urgent and strange errand.
I woke, grafted to her, in a vague, translucent hammock of dread.
Grafted to her. There's just so much loaded up in those few lines. You know, I often say that I think of a poem as sort of having a natural progression, but then when something completely blindsides you, you get something special out of it. So mm-hmm. it's not just about being grafted to somebody and all that stuff. A lot of poets would have ended right there. And he says, I woke, grafted her in a vague, translucent hammock of dread.
Right. It's the dread that makes it the poem.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's his sketch. That's what he is drawing in his art. It's sort of like these two artists sort of drawing each other in oblique ways.
It's a great point, I think, about the way the form conveys the meaning of this poem. The beginning of this poem, you can't hear it on the podcast, but no one can draw fast enough is one line. To capture the cut, that's another line. Mm-hmm. Iris before its form falls from its former self. The lines, they cut away at each other and they reveal each other mm-hmm. as you move down the page. But then by the time you get to the end of this poem, they each become their own sentence. She rendered in a careful hurry. She drew into the night as the iris died. Everything becomes much slower, as if the revelation from the beginning has happened and the picture has emerged there in front of you. Let's listen to another poem by James Galvin.
I've written a lot of poems about how, well, you know, we call it big sky country for a reason, and how living on the land out there is really much more of a sensation of living in the sky. And then the Forest Service wanted to do some experiments on my property, and so they sent me an aerial photo of where I live, and it just generated this poem because it made my whole piece of land look like a tree.
Here's James Galvin reading on first seeing a U.S. Forest Service aerial photo of where I live.
All those poems I wrote about living in the sky were wrong. I live on a leaf of a fern of frost growing up your bedroom window in 40 below. I live on a needle of a branch of a cedar tree, hard bitten, striving in six directions, rooted in rock, a cedar tree made of other trees, not cedar, but fir, lodgepole, and blue spruce, metastasizing like bacteria to the fan lip of a draw to draw water as soon as it slips from the snowdrift's grip and flows downward from branch to root, a tree running in reverse. Or I live on a thorn, on a trellis, trained, restrained, maybe cut back to hold up those flowers I've only heard of to whatever there is and isn't above.
This reminds me of one of those images that you get in a movie or a film or something where you start way out in space and then it's sort of that vertiginous precision, you know, that draws, comes back, goes down really quickly to a specific place on the earth, you know, where you feel it once you've been given something that's very, very precise and yet also you're all over the place. You know,
it
has a scary feel to it.
So a pattern emerges where seeing this aerial photo of the trees, he sees, he says, a tree running in reverse. I mean, it's sort of almost, to me, it's almost like a fractal where, you know, the shapes are contained within similar shapes and that the contours contain themselves almost into infinity, that the landscape reveals itself in the way you're describing, sort of endlessly closing in on itself and enlarging itself in the same patterns almost.
Yeah, it takes off from the poem we just read. In that poem, the image of the cut iris expanded out into an emotional suggestion, became an emotional register of the relationship. And in this one, the images, you go all the way down to the closeness of the image, and then they ramify back out. He ends this poem with,
or I live on a thorn, on a trellis, trained, restrained, maybe cut back to hold up those flowers I've only heard of to whatever there is and isn't above.
So suddenly you're all the way back out in the heavens.
And anything can be there. Whatever there is and isn't above. That's real aboveness if you are rooted on the earth and there's nothing but expanse above you. That outlines the distance that the poem addresses. And what's really kind of nice about it is his admission at the very beginning that because of this view, this revelation, he has to say, all those poems I wrote about living in the sky were wrong.
Right. He's got to start all over.
Right. Back up.
Yeah. Sadiqa De Meyer's first book of poems, Leaving How Island, came out just this year. She's a Canadian poet whose family left Holland when she was young.
Like James Galvin, De Meyer is intensely interested in landscapes. The first poem we're going to hear takes place in an exhibit of landscape paintings.
I'm drawing on my own memories there as someone who emigrated from the Netherlands to Canada and at a fairly early age. And so it's a looking back to that landscape and a speculation on how it might have shaped the speaker of the poem.
A few clarifications before we listen. A stickleback is a small fish about the size of a minnow with a spiky spine. The poem also has one almost unpronounceable Dutch word.
Yeah, landschap is the Dutch word for landscape and is actually also the origin of the English word.
Here's Sadiqa De Meyer reading Pastorals in the Atrium.
The tour has only started when I'm ambushed by that flatline verdigris I know even as a stumbling sleepwalker, landschap with tin river, cleaver of sodden pastures. Marvelous for painters, says the docent, was the enormity of the sky, rarely cloudless, and she's already turning to an Italian hillscape when I say, wait, this is my bloodstream as my finger makes brief unintended contact with the canvas. And then my voice in ambulance, I tell her there should be a diagram to indicate the grazing motion, how the grinding molars of the Holsteins make the river go. Or else, self-portrait in the glassing over eye of a stickleback caged in a jam jar, left too long in the sun. But now the river is across the room because the docent has ushered me toward an upholstered bench and is murmuring, "Sit, sit, I have here from the staff room a coffee. Here you are." And I'm making the gesture for no, those fields I ate and was made of live in me, unclosable parentheses.
It's funny, I just used the word vertiginous. This, in the second line of this poem, you get, "I'm ambushed by that flat-lined verdigris," mm-hmm. which is so close to vertigo. And the poem seems to be about an experience of vertigo of some sort, right?
Yeah. You can really hear how her inherited experience of, say, dual languages plays into this poem, because the sounds of it are amazing to me.
Landschap with tin river, cleaver of sodden pastures. Marvelous for painters, says the docent, was the enormity of the sky, rarely cloudless.
You know, it's just sort of that rush of language, the pleasure in it that I think somebody takes when they have had to acquire it and accumulate it. You know, the first language is sort of what you use to communicate and to, you know, what you need, and your language sort of connects with that in an immediate way. But the pleasure that she takes in that sort of rushing syntax here is exactly part of the landscape that she's described, because after all, she's not painting it, she's verbalizing it.
Yeah, and that syntax is where to focus. It slows down in places how the grinding molars of the Holsteins make the river go, which is wonderful. So everything suddenly becomes slow and textured in a different way. And then the way that she makes you feel this strangeness later in the poem is, look how we hear this person talking.
The docent has ushered me toward an upholstered bench and is murmuring, "Sit, sit, I have here from the staff room a coffee."
Now, who would say that? "I have here from the staff room a coffee." I mean, it's as if the language is slipping out of place.
And I'm making the gesture for no, those fields I ate and was made of live in me, unclosable parentheses.
Let's hear another poem about landscape by Sadiqa de Meyer. This one is called Lake Ontario Park.
I live in Kingston, Ontario. It's a local park on the water. And from this park, you can see a few islands out in the lake. And one of them, I think you can just see the very tip of it, is Amherst Island.
Amherst Island is named after Geoffrey Amherst, the British general, who's best known for his conquest of New France during the French and Indian War. Sadiqa de Meyer's poem has an epigraph, a sentence from a letter that Amherst wrote in 1763 to one of his commanders.
P.S. You will do well to try to inoculate the Indians by means of blankets, as well as to try every other method that can serve to extirpate this execrable race.
Here's Sadiqa de Meyer reading Lake Ontario Park.
Over the warming ground, swings toll like clock tower bells. Squirrels spiral the trunk of a pine. We fill a pail with sand. The day is robin's eggshell fine. My mother's shoulder had three shallow scars, shining archipelago, the quiet theaters of our lives. Immune is a sung word, skirting sorrow. Kneeling at no registry of toddlers with amorphous voices, night sweats without monument. The lake has the sea on its breath. One man has an island.
Well, you can't help but think, you know, of no man is an island, and here one man has an island. It's an interesting facet, I think, of most places with any history, that areas where significant events transpire turn into parks. They're sort of domesticated. And the idea is to preserve historical memory, but actually it turns them into part of the landscape that you don't pay much attention to, or that you just look around and you say, well, that's pretty, or, you know, you're a tourist in your own history.
Yeah, and the point of that statement in John Donne's beautiful passage, you know, "No man is an island entire unto himself," is that we are all connected in some way. It's very much the point of Christina Davis's poems. It ends with those famous lines about, "Don't ask for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." Mm-hmm. You know? And she is saying in this poem, these acts that were done, in some way we are still doing. There's some way we are responsible for them, and they're connected to us. You know, she talks about her mother there in this beautiful line. It seems like it's a very straightforward line.
My mother's shoulder had three shallow scars, shining archipelago.
Very beautiful,
yeah.
But disturbing, because suddenly it's very local, this thing that happened so long ago.
Yeah. And I mean, now what tolls are the swings that toll like clock tower bells. It describes a kind of peacefulness, that is to say, not being at war and, you know, a domestic scene, but underwriting it is quite a lot of frightening history.
Yeah, it's very expertly, affectingly done. It's a beautiful poem. In the July and August double issue, we have a section called Remembering Poets, which are short essays of personal observations of various poets. Margie Perloff writes about Allen Ginsberg. Donald Hall writes about Richard Wilbur.
Joshua Meegan writes about James Dickey. Claire Kavanaugh about Wislawa Szymborska.
And Bianca Stone writes about her grandmother, Ruth Stone. Bianca Stone is herself a poet as well as a visual artist, and she lives in Brooklyn. But she's joining us today from Middlebury, Vermont. Hi, Bianca.
Hi, guys.
So Ruth Stone died in 2011, and when the obituaries came out, you say that you couldn't bear hearing all of the mythologies about your grandmother. What are those mythologies exactly?
Well, I think that what bothered me the most is that people always talked about her only getting recognition in her late 80s. And really, she had lived this whole full life of poetry ever since, you know, the 40s or even earlier. And also that she lived in poverty and constant grief over her husband. And in a way, it's true in her poems that she writes a lot about grief beautifully and a lot about struggling as a single mother and living in a house without running water all the time. But I think that it also dismissed so much of her influence, her entire life on other poets and students. And I wanted people to ask more questions, you know, and think more openly about her life.
Now, one of the people she influenced was you. In the piece, you say that she would say to you, "We're a pair, you and I, we're buddies." And what was it like being buddies with Ruth Stone?
I spent every summer with her and a lot of winters staying with her in Binghamton where she was teaching. It's not every poet that opens up their world to their children or their grandchildren and encourages them to do poetry as well or art. And she bought me a typewriter. We played poetry games. So, I mean, definitely I was, you know, influenced to no end by her. I wouldn't be a poet right now if it wasn't for her. But also, like, more famous poets, I think Sharon Olds, she came up really early in her life and spent time with my grandma. And I think grandma's friends, such as, you know, Dick Wilbur, Robert Bly, and there was lots of different students and poets coming through.
You do a great job of bringing in your piece of suggesting some of that vitality of her life and mind and how it got diminished in the mythologies. It comes through in the poems, though, and I wonder if we can have you read one of those poems, maybe something that was originally published in Poetry Magazine?
Yeah, I got this off the Poetry Foundation website. I'm not 100% sure if it was actually in Poetry Magazine. It's called 1941. I wore a large brim hat, like the woman in the ads. How thin I was, such skin. Yes, it was Indianapolis. A taste of sin. You had a natural afro, no money for a haircut. We were in the seedy part, the buildings all run down, the record shop, the jazz impeccable. We moved like the blind, relying on our touch. At the corner coffee shop, after an hour's play with our serious game on paper, the waitress asked us to move on. It wasn't much. Oh, mortal love, your bones were beautiful. I traced them with my fingers. Now the light grows less. You were so angular. The air darkens with steel and smoke. The cracked world about to disintegrate in the arms of my total happiness.
I love the way that ends. The cracked world about to disintegrate in the arms of my total happiness. That fusion of emotions.
It seems to be absolutely delighting in a memory, an intimate memory of her late husband. But it's also so dark at the end. The light grows less. the air darkening, and yet still there's this joy.
Yeah.
It's such a scene. The jazz and the serious game on paper almost sounds like poetry, you know, but it's a little wry. I mean, it just paints such a picture of the 40s, I think, and of her and her spirit in the 40s and being in this marriage with another poet and how rich and vibrant it was and how she still drew on that romantic wartime jazz and poetry life throughout her whole life in her poems.
I'm struck by the image of the arm in that poem. And in your piece, you say that her relationship with the world existed with one arm and foot beyond the veil. Hmm. And you say, yeah, like her poetry, she was extremely present and yet always elsewhere in the ether, out in the Milky Way. Can you talk about that a little bit? How the ways in which she was present but always elsewhere?
Yeah, I think her poetry is so direct and so present. And it just lets you in so quickly. I mean, the first line, I wore a large brimmed hat like the woman in the ads. I mean, it's just very direct, very clear. And yet at the same time, it feels very, it's not dreamlike, but almost ethereal. She's always kind of reaching into this other space in consciousness and our perceptions of the world. So it's deceptively simple, I feel. And I think that she wasn't a religious person, she was an atheist, but always felt strongly about the universe around us having some sort of control in our life and how the universe almost plays a part in our writing of poetry. In other words, there's some part of writing poetry that is beyond us, beyond what we can say, that just happens naturally, the kind of enigmatic part of writing poetry.
You also say that she talked to herself constantly, right? Does that tell us about that?
Yeah, she did. I think it's probably normal for poets to kind of mutter while they're writing to kind of get the music. But she talked, especially driving, and well, all the time she would talk to herself, and she almost seemed to be talking. Sometimes I could hear her, and it sounded like she was talking to Walter, you know, her husband. And I think that it's similar in her poems, where in a way she's talking to the dead. She's really reaching out to the dead, and also to the universe, I mean, I guess. But yeah, she was always ready to write a poem. I think she did have a really intense internal world. And that's why her poems feel so immediate and fresh and have a kind of fervor and need to be written.
I'm not sure why, but I was surprised that in your essay you say that she suffered from constant anxiety. Can you tell us about that? I mean, her poems are so confident and, you know, have such a sure grasp of everything.
Yeah, it's so true. I read her poems and I think, my God, this is the same person, such confidence and such fearlessness in looking at the really difficult things. But in reality, she had a huge amount of anxiety, especially surrounding her daughters and me when I was there or whatever, about losing them. I think it sprang from her husband committing suicide so abruptly. She would get really scared about not being able to get a hold of people. It was really constant, and she had a lot of anxiety about that, or driving too fast, or she didn't want me to go to college far away. She hated that I went to school in Ohio. She felt better having the people she loved close by. So yeah, she suffered a lot of anxiety.
Let me include one more poem here, Bianca. Don and I did the Centennial Anthology for Poetry Magazine. This past year was our centennial celebration, and we included a poem by Ruth Stone in it, a little poem called Forecast, which is quite different from the one you read. The thing about Ruth Stone's poetry is she has very different registers. Some of these poems, as you know, can be very straightforward and transparent, and then she can sometimes do things that are incredibly musical, like this poem. This poem is called Forecast. Isabel, I could vainly map a happy veil of dolls and balls and tell the most various bears a really tale. But lap to lap the fretting Isabel, pale in her skinny pout, her wishing well is full of wishes no one can unspell. Knot's legs, Knot's arms, Knot's hair. The world of Tots smiles like a pumpkin into my despair. I see the lightning in her summer stare, and I would not by any bribe be kin or kith or share in all the crying she will bring to bear.
Mm.
Now, that's a surprising little poem that starts out to be a celebration of a little girl, and then suddenly, oh my goodness, look at the grief. It's latent in latent in her happiness.
Yeah, I love that pumpkin.
Yeah,
it's so musical. Yeah. It's like Yeats, or actually, sometimes she reminds me of Dylan Thomas, the way she's rhyming, and it's, you know, very musical. So musical. Probably because she started writing in the 40s and 50s when there was a lot of form and music.
Bianca, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
You can read Bianca Stone's essay and everything else you heard on this program in the July and August issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox with help from Posey Gruner.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.